Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, McRae Dallas, the man at the center of election fraud elections in the North Carolina 9th District, has been charged. Republican Mark Harris drops out and throws his support to someone else. Democrat Dan McCready is in it to win it and raising money to do so. Governor Cooper's State of the State address focuses on helping public schools, Medicaid, and working together. And a gun is found at Myers Park High. Or is it? Our roundtable of reporters is ready to detail those and other stories, and those reporters include Steve Harrison, political reporter here for WFAE News. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And Doss Helms has reported on education for the Charlotte Observer. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Eric Spanberg is managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Hello there.
Hello, Mike.
And we welcome, for the first time, Jonathan Lowe, reporter for Spectrum News.
Good morning.
Good morning. Nice to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
We'll go easy on you.
For the first
20 minutes.
This should be fun.
And you can watch Jonathan. He's facing the camera on Facebook Live. We put the camera in front of you because we knew you'd be used to it.
I like that.
So last week, the State Board of Elections called for a new election in the 9th Congressional District after Republican candidate Mark Harris called for new elections. The man at the center of all this, of all the fraud allegations at least, is McRae Dallas. He refused to testify last week. That did not help him. This week, he was arrested and charged and appeared before a magistrate in the Wake County Jail to hear those charges read.
Mr. Dallas? Is that how you say it? Okay. Sir, they have served a grand jury indictment on you. They are for 3 counts of felony obstruction of justice, 2 counts of conspiring to commit felonious obstruction of justice, and 2 counts of possession of absentee ballots.
She is clearly the only woman in the state who has not heard this man named.
That's right.
Again, those charges against McRae Dallas and 4 others, 3 counts of felony obstruction of justice, 2 counts of conspiring to commit felonious obstruction of justice, and 2 counts of possession of absentee ballots. Now, the indictment was obtained by Wake County District Attorney Lauren Freeman, who, when speaking to WRAL-TV, said Dallas's actions serve to undermine the integrity of the absentee ballot process and the public's confidence in the outcome of the electoral process.
This is a step towards trying to restore confidence in the voting process, which is so critical to our democracy.
So, Steve, these charges not only involve the last 9th District primary election, but also the 2016 general election. Officials have known about this problem for years. Is this legal action only happening now because of the bright white spotlight that hit the Bladen County and Robeson County with this last election?
I can't say for certain, but I think it's probably a good guess that without the massive publicity about this, that we would not be here.
Why?
Well, I don't know why. I know that the State Board of Elections in January of 2017 sent a very thorough investigative file to the feds and to local prosecutors, really laying out very detailed what had happened in Bladen County. Nothing happened. They were very frustrated. And then finally we got to November, it became a big show, and now here we are, and he's been arrested and charged.
So for the magistrate in Wake County, please tell us who McRae Dallas is and why he's the center of this.
So
Remind us.
He is...
It's Dallas, right?
he is a Bladen County political operative whose specialty was running a very aggressive absentee by mail ballot program. Mm-hmm. He has worked for Democrats and Republicans. For the past year, he worked for Mark Harris. And his specialty was in getting people to request ballots and then, as it turns out, having his employees go back and illegally pick them up.
So the charge of 2 counts of possession of absentee ballots, I understand, because that's what this is all about. Why the counts of obstruction of justice and conspiring to commit obstruction of justice?
So this case dates back to the November 2016 election. The Board of Elections was already had their own investigation at that time, and 2 of the people who were also charged, Caitlin Kroom and Matthew Mattis, were his employees. And they have text messages where Dallas is kind of coaching them on what to say, like, don't admit to anything, you didn't do this, this is what to say, et cetera, et cetera. So that's what that focuses on. And then if you go back really just last week or 2 weeks ago, elections investigator said he was still doing that right before the hearing for the McCready-Harris race, that he was trying to get one of the star witnesses to take the fifth and say that she did nothing wrong and that he did nothing wrong.
Well, and his stepdaughter had testified about kind of what the script was, what the answer is if somebody asks you. I think one of the interesting things here is, as you said, Mike, this is for the 2016 general and 2018 primary,
yes.
Which of course would leave out
the general,
the 2018 general, which I would only imagine means that's yet to come.
Yeah, and well, if I could add your original question, if I could take it back, and it kind of dovetails off what Steve said about why this got so much attention or publicity, as Steve said, I'd like to remind folks, the State Board of Elections did not certify the race. And I think that's what piqued everyone's interest. Why did they not certify? If you remember, the vice chairman at the time, who's no longer with the state board or with the State Board of Elections, had that meeting where he just said, what I've found out in Robeson County and in Bladen County has just floored me. And I think everybody kind of collectively looked at that and said, this needs more attention.
You bring up an interesting point too, Eric, and that is the fact that this is about the 2016 general and the 2018 primary, but not the 2018 general, which is where the kerfuffle actually
right.
began. And Wake County DA Lauren Freeman has met with elections board investigators, and she told WRAL that more shoes are likely to drop as they investigate other aspects of these allegations in the 9th District.
Who knew what was happening and who was financing it? And is there any, you know, illegal conduct related to that? And so we will continue to pursue that. I think we also heard last week the possibility of, you know, whether there have been efforts by some of these people and maybe others to obstruct ongoing investigations.
But if they know enough about the 2018 primary to levy charges, why don't they know enough about the general?
Well, I think that they're still collecting evidence, I think, is what's going on. In other words, it's not just going to be a cursory, oh, by the way, you did this and this. It's going to be a full accounting. And I think this all goes back to where the conversation between you and Steve started, which is there's been so much media sunlight put on this issue now that investigators feel compelled to dig through all of this. And I would be really surprised if this doesn't go beyond just a couple of people.
I was going to say, what she said was, I think, you know, who financed it. So that would be, will they be able to, we know who financed it. That was Mark Harris's campaign and the Red Dome Group. But the question will be whether Harris or the Red Dome Group actually knew what they were buying.
And Steve, wouldn't you go back to, we had the 2016 general and the 2018 primary. But remember, in the 2016 primary, you had the third candidate in that Republican primary who got,
221 out of 226.
Out of 226. I mean, that obviously is a very skewed number. So I just wonder if they'll go back to that as well while they're looking at the 2018 general. In other words, there's a lot left to look at.
And a lot of the information about the 2018 general election came out at this recent Board of Elections hearing, which seems like forever in the news cycle world, but really in the investigative world, they are probably still digging through a lot of that to say who said what, who lied, who obstructed justice.
So Dallas was arraigned or indicted and is went to the bond. Is he still in jail?
He was bonded out yesterday.
The bond was $30,000. Okay. Not charged were Lisa Britt and Kelly Hendricks, who testified. Who was charged aside from McCray Dallas? Do we know?
So four other people, two of them were Caitlin Crew, Matthew Mattis, were part of that 2016 state board investigation. They worked for him, and they, you know, talked in great deal about what they did, how they picked up ballots, et cetera, et cetera. And then the second part of McCray Dallas telling them, like, we all got to stay together. Don't talk. So
there were also conflicting moments in testimony at the hearing, particularly between Mark Harris and his son, John, which revealed the existence of emails that hadn't been presented and different stories being told. Is Mark Harris likely to be investigated, yes, but likely to be indicted?
I'm glad you asked the question. I was waiting for somebody to. It's like everyone is wondering if he's going to be the next shoe that drops because of the question of who financed it and who knew. But that for me was the most telling moment when his son was up there just saying how much he tried to warn his dad that the numbers don't add up with this guy and what he does and how he does it.
And you're right, Jonathan. And this is going to come down to, in part, we don't know what the investigators will have, obviously, but it's going to come down in part to the argument that Mark Harris made and has made consistently, which is that he thought that McRae Dallas was doing this in a legitimate fashion. Mm-hmm. And so what do people believe between those two viewpoints will be a big question.
And there is
here.
A big gap between looking guilty in the court of public opinion, which I think a lot of people watched that testimony and said, oh, man, that does not smell good, versus being able to prove in a court of law that he actually knew, that he wasn't just this naive guy who trusted the man who kept telling him, honest, I'm not cheating.
This is a national story. It has been for months, and that's a problem for the Republican Party, one would think. But Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has raised a question about all this. He wanted to know why absentee mail ballot harvesting, which is what this is in the 9th District, is illegal in North Carolina but legal in California.
Yeah, he spoke about this earlier this week, and there was a lot of outrage at the first part of his speech where he talked about voter fraud. People felt like he was blaming the Democrats for that. But then the second half of his speech was about, like you said, in California, 3 years ago, they passed a new law that said anyone could pick up ballots. And in this last election in November, operatives were bringing in boxes and boxes of mail ballots. Like they had McRae Dallas's all over the state doing this, and it's all okay. And it's just interesting. I think he made the point, you know, he's getting on Democrats for saying, how come, you know, we're not going after this in California? I just thought it was interesting that we've been so focused on ballot harvesting here, and in other places, California, Washington, Colorado, you can do it.
So is it true that in a tweet, McConnell was blaming North Carolina Democrats for what happened because Democrats don't support voter ID? Is that true?
Well, it's certainly true that his speech was conflating voter fraud at the polls versus absentee ballot fraud. And remember, that he made several comments about how Democrats, he would welcome Democrats to finally recognize the importance and the problem of voter fraud, but that's not accurate, because what the Republicans have been pushing for is voter ID and things that would safeguard people actually going to the polls. This is not about that. This is about absentee ballots. And all of the nonpartisan studies have said that it's the absentee ballots that are the big problem. So I think he's confusing the issue a little bit.
Yeah, and if you look deeper with what we're talking about here, you know, hats off to reporters like, you know, Joe Bruno, and who actually went down to Blaine County and talked to people who were involved with this and picked up the ballots. There was question about what people said wanted their vote to be and what may have been recorded on the actual ballot, and then it was picked up. So it's that to me doesn't sound like ID fraud.
So Mark Harris, who technically won by, 905 votes, has decided not to run again. Is that because of the ongoing investigation, or was there some other?
He says it's health.
Okay. Would the state GOP have allowed him to run, or is he simply too tainted at this point? Do they just need a fresh start?
Well, I don't know that they could have stopped him from running, but you can encourage people in other ways by maybe not offering support in the way that you might have.
So we'll come back. We'll talk about who is running, who we think is running, and what all of that means. We'll also talk about the State of the State address, which the governor made on Monday. And there's a lot more news that has nothing to do with the 9th Congressional District. I know it's hard to believe, but it's true. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks, the local news roundup on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup because it's Friday. And Jonathan Lowe is here, reporter for Spectrum News. Eric Spanberg, managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal, and Doss Helms, education reporter for the Charlotte Observer, and Steve Harrison, reporter for us here at WFAE. Mark Harris is out of the running in the ninth by his choice, but he endorsed Union County Commissioner Stoney Rushing for the seat. Is that a blessing or a curse for Mr. Rushing?
Well, the Democrats certainly jumped in to say it's the most toxic endorsement you can imagine, that Mark Harris is tainted and that therefore he tainted Stoney Rushing. But I think I was among many, many, many people who heard that name and thought, I don't know much about him, and looked at his Facebook page. And we discovered that Stoney Rushing has quite a persona of his own.
Meanwhile, back in Hazard County.
I mean, I think this is a blessing for the national media, or all media.
Well, that's comedians
because,
across
because
the country.
One of the first, I don't know why they would even investigate this, but New York Magazine had a post on their website of Rushing's Facebook page, which features weeks of posts by him, allegedly, denying any possibility of election fraud in the ninth and implying the investigation was politically motivated. In one post, he claims to have contacted the Justice Department to complain about a political coup that had occurred in the district. Has anyone corroborated that?
That he called the Justice Department?
Yeah, that these are actually his Facebook pages, posts?
Well, he hasn't denied it, so okay. I would think that that's, you know, if it wasn't his, he probably would have denied it. He also referred to the Elections Board as corrupt, among other things, so he very much was on Mark Harris's side, which I think would partially explain the quick endorsement.
He's a Union County Commissioner. Now, that's what we know about him. But we also know from his Facebook page, because this really did make the national press, he has photographs of himself, multiple pictures of himself dressed like Jefferson Davis Boss Hogg from the old TV show, The Dukes of Hazzard. Remind us who Boss Hogg was.
He was basically a fictitious, corrupt and clueless Southern politician. So, as one of the many tweets said, the jokes just write themselves.
Apparently, Stoney's, he has a distant relative who was a moonshiner who was maybe the inspiration for the Boss Hogg character. So that's why he's embraced...
Yes.
Embrace this, and of course, then it becomes his slogan that Stoney, he owns a ranch, shooting range,
yes,
that he is protecting the Second Amendment like a boss.
I think that the writers at Saturday Night Live are going into overload right now. They don't know what to do.
Why
exactly
have the election? Just give it to him.
Yeah, it would be so much fun. There's already a parody Twitter account at Stoney Boss, which includes, among other things, a clip from a Union County Commissioner's meeting, and I have not verified it, but it looks real, in which Stoney is threatening to somebody else, another commissioner, is fixing to be in the middle of getting his rear end whipped. And so I think that there will be more interesting stuff. Esquire had a headline saying, North Carolina's 9th district is absolutely nuts. And it referred to the newly insane state of North Carolina.
Wow.
I find it so interesting that knowing all of that, that's, you know, Mark Harris endorsed.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? What are they, just friends, personal friends maybe? Do we know?
I don't know. I mean, I had never heard of this candidate until this week. Of course, Union County is very important, though, to this race.
It is. It's one of the two counties that Mark Harris won.
And Mark Harris felt like, during the first half of this scandal and investigation, he felt like the statewide Republicans let him down. They did not have his back. He said that in the WBTV interview, and then things kind of turned around after that. But Stoney Rushing, I think, was with him the whole
and night. I think you're exactly right, Steve, because he was very vocal. Mark Harris, was very vocal about that. And you remember, it was only after that interview that Dallas Woodhouse and Robin Hayes and others in the party really began to fight for Harris to keep his seat. Before that, they were pretty much silent or saying that maybe things need to be investigated.
Mm. So who are the other people rumored to be or thinking about running in the ninth? Republicans.
So you have Matthew Ridenour, who was a former Mecklenburg County commissioner who lost this past time. You've had the Union County chairman of the Republican Party, Dan Barry. Who else?
Kenny Smith floated
Kenny
as well.
Smith.
Tucker from Tommy
Tucker. Oh, Tommy Tucker. Yeah, he's
former
definitely
state senator.
Yes, former state senator.
Robert Pittenger has said he's not running.
He's not running.
And the former McCrory's not running.
Not running. He said he had no fire in the belly for a congressional bid. But Democrat Dan McCready is running, and he said last week's hearing revealed, quote, a culture of corruption. We saw emails that were hidden from the board under subpoena. We saw lying on the stand. But he said that the board's unanimous decision to hold new elections shows we care about our democracy in North Carolina.
A lot of people in North Carolina right now have been shaken by this process. I think our job now as we go forward in this campaign is to show people that it doesn't matter if you're a Democrat or Republican or independent or if you're from Charlotte or from Bladen County or anywhere in between. I want to show people a kind of leadership that people can be proud of.
He only lost by 905 votes. That obviously must be helping his fundraising activities. How much has he raised?
He raised $500,000 by the end of last year. I think he has about $340,000 on hand. He's got a very strong start. But let's also remember that it was a slim margin. As you say, he was within 900 votes. And let's also remember that this district has gone Republican for 55, 56 years. So there's no slam dunk here.
So will this scandal, essentially, in the 9th District light a fire under Republicans, or has it hurt them to the point where people might be willing to vote for Dan McCready just because he's the Democrat and he's untainted in this?
I think your question, I don't have an answer to that question, but I think that's the right question. That's really what we're watching.
I will say that I went down to Union County the other day and talking to voters in Union County, which is a Republican stronghold in the 9th District, they honestly feel like whatever happened needs to be investigated thoroughly.
Mm-hmm.
But I did not get the sense from them that they would vote for a Democrat.
Okay. Is he likely to have a challenger in the primary? Because there's a primary in the Democratic.
McCready?
I don't understand.
I would be surprised personally. I just think with the strength of what he already has in the bank and name recognition, I think it would be very difficult to knock him out.
So Governor Roy Cooper proclaimed the state to be determined to overcome the ravages of hurricanes, help cities and rural communities, and support public schools. That and more with his annual State of the State address, which he delivered on Monday night at the State House. I've heard very little about this. Was it well received? Anybody know?
I think it was well received. I think there is some common ground on the school bond between both Democrats and Republicans. He also called to expand Medicaid. There is much less interest in working on that. Phil Berger, his response was a little more partisan. He talked a lot about judicial overreach, which I think we're going to get to a little bit later in the show about striking down those two constitutional amendments.
I think it's interesting that, particularly on the school funding, that you're seeing, at least publicly, you're seeing more agreement between the governor and House Speaker Tim Moore, who's obviously a Republican, and then Phil Berger, who's the Republican head of the Senate, is not in favor of a bond package. So,
well, Tim Moore, the Speaker of the House, is in sync with the governor.
Yes,
on wanting his K-12 package. They want a debt. They want a referendum on a bond.
Right.
The Senate is okay with it, but they don't want any debt.
Right.
So I don't know how you accomplish it without having a bond, which is debt.
Well, you would, you pay it out of the budget. You pay as you go.
Okay. He delivered this before, this is the first speech he's delivered since the General Assembly lost its supermajority, since Republicans lost their supermajority in that, and he made a point of alluding to that.
The people of North Carolina are determined for us to work together. They have spoken. They want a more balanced approach to government.
So given the fact that the supermajority is gone, but the Republicans still control the thing, are they likely to work more carefully or closely with it?
The initial response, even Phil Berger said that, there is going to have to be a little more bipartisanship when it comes to budget matters. So, the proof will be what happens later this year. But it sounds like they're prepared to have at least a little more agreement. But then again, it would be hard to fall off the floor.
And one thing you mentioned, Steve, was the fact that he wants to expand Medicaid, which he said would cover hundreds of thousands of low- and middle-income residents, help rural hospitals save lives, and bring tens of thousands of jobs. And a guy named Paul Sprecht with the Raleigh News and Observer spoke with WFAE's Lisa Wharf this week about that last claim, and the News and Observer fact-checked the claim, rating it mostly true. It could create about 40,000 jobs, mostly in the healthcare sector. Does the prospect of 40,000 jobs perk the interest of Republicans who might be against this ordinarily?
Remember, Cooper campaigned on this. This is not a new issue. There is a little more openness from Republicans to consider it with some key caveats. So whether they will do that, you know, we'll find out later this session. But remember, the 300 to 500,000 people that would be treated with this expansion, the 40,000 jobs, that's all been discussed for years. And initially when it was rejected, North Carolina was like a lot of other states in that it was under Republican control and they did not want to go along with what we all called Obamacare at the time. So this isn't new. It's just a matter of whether the time passing has changed anyone's mind.
Getting back to the school bond that the Speaker of the House is in favor of, but Phil Berger in the Senate is not. And what would this do for schools if it were to pass?
Well, it would be school construction. And I have not seen a breakdown. I don't believe that there is a breakdown as far as, you know, being able to say CMS would get X amount of dollars or it would build these schools. But there is definitely seems to be a state will to provide some additional money for school construction and for teacher raises. You can just pretty much guarantee there will be some kind of teacher raise in this package.
Would this go to all schools, or would it be equitably distributed, or would it be mostly in the rural areas or mostly in the urban areas?
Well, that's a great question, because the Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools folks have been very concerned about what they called tiered funding, in which and it was not actually set out to be for everything. It was a pretty specific bureaucratic designation, but it designates, you know, the highest wealth counties, which of course are Mecklenburg, Wake, and ones like that,
right,
middle, and then lowest. And a lot of funding things, including the school safety package that came through, went to the least wealthy counties first, and there was little or nothing left over for the higher wealth counties. So I think that is a fear, that if there's a state bond, will everybody get a slice of it?
And Mike, going back to that question you asked me about, I'm sorry, just real quickly, that question you asked me about paying for the school construction and the Senate, one of the differences here is that by supporting a bond, the governor has said, then you can put more money from the actual budget into teacher salaries and principal salaries and things like that. So that's a key difference. I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to add that one of the things that I did hear is that this is going to help accelerate school construction projects that are behind districts that have schools that have, you know, should have been under construction long before now that haven't been started yet. So I think the state realized that there were a bulk of projects across the state, school construction, that needed to happen. So I think this funding will help accelerate that.
Well, although we try, the news cycle doesn't stop at 10 a.m. on Friday morning. Things actually happen right after we do the show. And last Friday, right after we did the show, a Wake County Superior Court judge ruled that two amendments to the state constitution are unconstitutional. Voters approved that voter ID amendment and one that would cap the state income tax back in November, but the judge said that the General Assembly was, quote, an illegally constituted General Assembly, does not represent the people of North Carolina, and is therefore not empowered to pass legislation that would amend the state's constitution. He's basing that on gerrymandering, which has been going on forever. How long before this goes to a higher court?
Sometime in 2019, okay. And you know,
10 minutes.
It was interesting. The you know, the two amendments, photo ID passed with 55% of the vote. I think the income tax was 57 about that. So big majorities. And so a lot of people said, how can a statewide vote be gerrymandered? The key point is that it's a two-step process to have a constitutional amendment. First, the General Assembly needs that 3/5 vote, and then, you know, if you don't get that, everything else stops. And so the idea is that there is not a true – that the idea was there was not a true Republican supermajority in the General Assembly because of the gerrymander, so everything, at least on those two issues, stops.
Well, Phil Berger said that the ruling could throw the entire state into chaos because every law passed since June 2017, including the budget, would be called into question. I believe Michael Bitzer, who was on this program on Tuesday, took issue with that. I've forgotten his reasoning behind that.
Yeah, in the ruling, the judge said that he kind of tailored it, very, very narrowly to these two amendments, and was very specific about this is about these two amendments and these two amendments only. So the idea that the budget, everything else is in turmoil, the judge said no.
Yeah, the judge is basically saying that the regular procedures and policies that the legislature carries out are still valid, but that when you're talking about
illegally constituted.
You'd have to ask the judge. This is just what he told us, is that he's telling everyone that the constitutional amendments are separate in a way, would not lead to the same kind of chaos as if you undid everything else that the legislature has done.
Okay, so we'll stay tuned to that.
Yes.
It was reported earlier this week that a gun was found and confiscated at Myers Park High School, but CMS officials now say no actual weapon was confiscated, but that law enforcement officials had enough evidence to determine that a student did have a weapon on the campus at some point. Okay, Ann, it's up to you. Explain this.
Well, and I did not do a lot of in-depth reporting on this, but my understanding is that there were social media images that showed a student with a gun. And because of that, the school went into lockdown. I was interested to see that one of my friends had posted that her daughter was under the table in a cafeteria, because one of the first things they say in the CMS active survival training is, do not get under a table. You will die under a table. Evidently, they're still getting under tables. But they went into lockdown. They did not find the gun. But they did feel like the images were conclusive enough to say that this particular student did have a gun on campus, so he has been charged.
And I know that there was a picture with the student with the image of what could have been a gun, but there was also a video as well. So out of an abundance of caution, I think they went into lockdown. But did you see the video of them running out of the cafeteria? I mean, it caused there was a social media video that's out now of students in the cafeteria at Myers Park High School. And when this all happened, apparently that threat or whatever ended up on social media got back to students that there was going to be some sort of shooting on campus, and all of the students then run out of the cafeteria. Wow. It's quite alarming to see because of all the panic that ensued. I know that Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools came out and said that there was no gun or anything found. CMPD investigated it. There was a police report that was filed, and they apparently may have found a gun off campus.
Have they identified, since there was social media video, have they identified the student?
I believe they did identify the student, and CMPD investigated that further. I do not know that part of
the story. I think he has been charged.
That I do not know.
Yeah.
Well, whether or not there was a gun, there seems to be a gun now every single week.
Yes.
Being discovered.
I mean, we just had Ranson Middle.
Right.
And we had South Mech.
The gun found in the trash can. Before that, it was South Mech, and that was actually a loaded firearm in the South Mech case.
So when, except for this case, which popped up on social media, are these being found, these weapons being found?
Yes.
As the result of the random searches, or
no.
Because students are saying
no.
The searches have not been turning up any guns, which again they say is
pepper
fairly
spray.
Expected. Yeah, a couple of pepper sprays, but these have been very selective, very small numbers of students being screened.
Okay. When we come back, City Council had some rancorous moments in their meeting on Monday night. We'll talk about that, and we'll talk about the Catch 2030 plan getting approved and more. Stay with us at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, the local news roundup, featuring Steve Harrison from WFAE News and Doss Helms, the Charlotte Observer, Eric Spanberg, managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal, Jonathan Lowe from Spectrum News. Emotions surrounding this county's, or this country's, immigration debate and the policies of the federal government's Immigration and Custom Enforcement Agency spilled into the City Council chamber on Monday night. Citizens were angry with both the council and Mayor Vyliles about what they saw as a lack of support for the immigrant community.
This failure to support our most vulnerable neighbors is a moral outrage.
It has been weeks of the raids. We have begged for your help.
You have remained silent. Silence is complicity.
So what have mayor and council not done that they want them to do?
So this all, for the most part, Mike, was directed at the mayor. Because if you remember, last week we had seven cities across the state sign a declaration basically asking for Immigration and Customs Enforcement to stop the raids that happened the previous week, where we saw more than 200 people, undocumented immigrants, being arrested across the state, most of them happening in East Charlotte. So the mayor that week, as we all know, she travels a lot. So that week that those other mayors across the state signed that declaration, the mayor was, she says, also working to set up that advisory committee. It's being chaired by Councilmember Larkin Eggleston. Mm-hmm. Matt Newton is on there, Braxton Winston.
And they're supposed to be going into the community.
Correct. Out into the community to directly talk to people about what's happening with these ICE raids and arrests, which Immigration and Customs Enforcement has said, they came here, did a news conference, said, this is the new normal. So they didn't hide behind anything. They said these raids and these arrests are, you know, of people who have a criminal history.
And she pointed out the fact that she had formed this ad hoc committee to the assembled multitudes on Monday night.
And I thought that would work. But it obviously isn't enough for what you expect of us or of me. And so what I'm willing to do is try to learn more about what you do expect.
She sounded a little chastened there.
And she did not, Mike, she did not specifically say that she will sign that.
Right.
She didn't answer that. That was everyone's question that came to, with all of that anger, that was their request. And even the meeting ended on kind of a contentious note because she kept saying, you know, I didn't do what you wanted me to. And people in the audience were firing. It was one of the few times that I've seen people in the audience talking directly with the mayor.
You're right, Mike. She sounded a little ruffled.
Yeah.
I mean, she doesn't sound like that often, but she sounded like she was surprised at the reaction.
Did that mollify the crowd?
No.
Okay.
And I think sometimes, I was just going to say, like,
they left some angry.
With some of these kind of social justice issues come before council, if council kind of signs the letter, signs the resolution, the pushback is words don't matter. In this case, they didn't. And then the argument is words do matter. and I think but this is kind of this is, I think, goes to the mayor's style that, you know, if you go back, the previous mayor, Jennifer Roberts, would have, I can't say for sure, would have signed that letter, right?
Absolutely.
She would have said, let's do this. I stand with you. And controversy would have ensued. And the city, I think it's important to know, is still terrified of Raleigh. They do not want to get involved in immigration fights. They're scared about what happened over HB2.
The county commission supported Gary McFadden. They signed this resolution, or passed a resolution last
unanimously.
Week. To support Gary McFadden's decision to end 287G, which allows ICE to come into the jails.
Yeah, no, I thought that was a very interesting contrast. And going back to your point, though, Steve, I think you were at the meeting a couple years ago. You remember when this immigration issue came up, and Jennifer Roberts, then mayor, stopped the meeting, and we all went out into the lobby so that they could essentially have a debate or a discussion about immigration and what the city couldn't do to help.
And then this is also why, remember, soon after that time, they stopped televising all the public comments.
Correct.
That they shut that down entirely. Now it's back.
Jonathan, we were more on the council here. They unanimously approved spending $2.1 million to help developers acquire and renovate an East Charlotte apartment complex called Sharon Oaks. This helps preserve what they're calling, this is a new term to me, naturally occurring affordable housing.
NOAA.
Yes, NOAA. That's the city staff jargon.
Is this the first chunk of the $50 million bond package put to work?
Yes, it is. The private sector and nonprofits are still raising. They're matching $50 million, but this is currently the first time the city is using money out of the bond money that was passed.
Is this new thinking to rehab essentially previous low-income housings and make it better and keep it online as affordable housing?
Yes. So the city is right now working on new framework for how they will determine affordable housing, and one of the things they're really looking to do is using city-owned land, and also using affordable or housing that's already established, fixing it up so that people can, the term is age in place.
And Republican Councilmember Ed Driggs says this paves the way for more projects like this. Have they identified other projects they'd like to put more money to in this manner?
I haven't heard any of any specific projects.
This is a definite shift in philosophy. Both of you are right, and you're going to see more of this, particularly when you see older apartment complexes. One of the things that the city wants to do is to have fewer episodes of developers coming in, knocking those down, and building more expensive apartments. So they want to keep those in place and keep the rents locked in for 15 years in this case.
So one, it is important to note that the 5,000 affordable units in 3 years goal. I talked to Councilmember Luana Mayfield about this. She said that while we are 80% of the way to completing that, they were not able to foresee the rate at which investors and outside hedge funds would come in and buy up property buildings.
Right.
So basically she led me to believe that while we are about to meet that goal, it still won't matter because the rate of people, investment companies coming in and buying up property.
Other big news, the Metropolitan Transit Commission voted on Wednesday to approve the 2030 CAT system plan, which, among other things, would take a new light rail line, the Silver Line, from Matthews to the airport through Uptown and then eventually to Belmont in Gastonia. This would be very expensive, $6 to $8 billion. The plan has been approved. What about the money?
Haven't got to that yet.
We've been talking about this for so long. This John Lewis, who runs CATS, has called it the back of the cocktail napkin estimate, $6 to $8 billion, and for
you know what that leads to, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah,
more money,
more cocktails. But not only CATS, but business leaders, others in local government have been talking for years about we need a regional approach for funding. We need to find new sources. We need to cobble together grants and all these things. And as far as I can tell, there's been zero progress on that.
I think the interesting thing in the vote was we've got this line from Matthews to the airport. It's got to get through Uptown somehow. There was talk of a tunnel, which would bring it right through Center City. They're going to take it all the way up by 277. And there was a lot of people questioning that. Like, if you're coming in from Matthews and the stop is going to be by I-277 and you have to then walk 15 minutes or wait to take the blue line.
Useless.
That was what a lot of people felt.
The two things in this that should be mentioned, while it does do the Silver Line, there's also going to be some changes to 485. They're going to extend the Blue Line past and take it into Pineville and Ballantyne, also what was approved in that transit plan. Instead of doing the red commuter rail line to North Mecklenburg County, we did finally hear that they are going to turn that into rapid bus transit when the I-77 toll lane.
How's that going to go over up there? That and the toll lane.
I'm so glad you asked. So think about this. If you're living in the northern part of the county, you're feeling like this has been a bait and switch all along because remember the commuter line was going to run along the existing rail line. Railroad won't let them do that. So you're right, Mike. It's just a recipe for political controversy added with the toll lanes.
John Lewis did not take that off the table when I talked to him yesterday, as far as he said we're still negotiating with Norfolk Southern.
Okay. We have to move on and do a lot of things very quickly here in the next 5 minutes, including the fact that the Charlotte-Mecklenburg School Board voted this week to end the continuous learning calendar program. That was a year-round school program at certain schools.
Just at four schools.
And they've decided to end it. Why?
Well, because there was no proof that it worked, which I think was a huge disappointment. This came as part of Project Lift. You had private donors that put up some extra money. It just stood to reason that the kids who probably were not going to expensive summer camps and were not having a lot of books in their home and who most needed the help would do better at not having a long summer break.
And I think, Jonathan, you reported that this approach was causing high absenteeism in the summer months, July and August, and that parents were complaining that students were failing academically. Are those two things connected?
Probably, because basically parents said, we want our summers. We want time to travel. So in July and August, kids weren't coming to school. It was very costly to run, $830,000 a year.
Okay.
Initially, they were going to extend it by 1 year. That was what the action item was. Board member Sean Strain then threw out an alternate motion to just end it now. So, in this, you have parents and families that now are not going to have anything to do this summer, not going to have school, but also the teachers and faculty and staff that won't get a paycheck, at least in July, and possibly be August.
There were some undertones of gentrification in all this, because the parents who had really said, we want to go back to a traditional calendar, were mostly white and affluent who had moved into the Biddleville neighborhood, into what used to be a very high poverty, virtually all black school. A lot of folks were saying, well, the parents who have been there longer like this program, and it's being taken away from
and
them.
And apparently the biggest education story this week was actually fake news. It centered around news that there was going to be a change in student grading, something that was never proposed. It was based on a mix of bad reporting and bad reading, sloppy reading. And CMS's Charles Jeter felt compelled to send out a correction. Explain what that's all about.
So what was actually proposed was not very sexy, which is why I didn't write about it. There is a school grading system in which schools are assigned letter grades. The proposal, the original plan would say that this year it would get harder to earn an A and easier to earn an F. So the motion was actually to keep it as is, although it was, if you were just looking at that, which apparently a Raleigh radio or TV station did,
right.
It looked like it was a change. So it was a combination of not understanding that it was not a change and not understanding that this was not student letter grades.
But none of that's true. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay, because Charles Jeter's statement correcting this was extraordinary in many ways. First, he started by quoting Vladimir Lenin, "A lie told often enough becomes the truth." And then he comes down really hard, and rightfully so, on the age of cost-cutting in media companies, in which one media outlet writes a story, it gets picked up by others as if it were accurate without any effort to independently confirm the story. And then he says, this is why our president can stand in front of crowds and convince his supporters that true stories written by these same media outlets are false.
Ooh.
This is, I'm not sure what the word is, condemnatory in so many ways.
Charlie Jeter has Charlie his Jeter opinions.
Scathing.
Charlie Jeter, by the way, a former Republican state lawmaker. So,
wow,
interesting comments about the president.
Okay, a troubling development this week in the Raekwon Boram trial. The judge was threatened. Who wants to take that? There was a recording that they played for the judge in the courtroom without the jury present, in which Raekwon Boram allegedly is calling somebody, spelling out the judge's name, and saying he needs relief from this judge.
I believe he was on the phone with his mother.
Okay. Right, it was
she
his
was
mother's number.
Spelling
right.
Yeah.
And the defense
the
wants
name.
The judge to recuse himself because obviously he can't be fair in the face of having heard that recording, which they felt compelled to play for the judge, and they want a mistrial. Are they likely to get one?
It didn't. The judge's response was that he knew that Boram knew that this call would be recorded and that people would hear it, so it would be unreasonable, I guess, to end it.
The bigger point for me was that the jury, the judge said, was not in the room, didn't hear it, doesn't have knowledge of it, so there's no reason to grant a mistrial.
So the Michael Cohen trial, which we'll hear a lot about in the next, not trial, but the hearing, but which we'll hear a lot about in the next program here. One of the big stars, one of the big moments in that was Mark Meadows from North Carolina, because he started off with contesting the whole hearing, and then he brought in a woman and said she was evidence that the president is not racist, something that Michael Cohen had alleged. And that set up an exchange between a Michigan Democrat who said the fact that someone would actually use a prop, a black woman, in this committee hearing is alone racist in itself. He claimed he was not racist and argued for it vehemently within the hearing. But the next day, this came out.
The more we find out, the more we realize how wrong the direction we're going. And so what we're going to do is take back our country. 2012 is the time that we're going to send Mr. Obama home to Kenya or wherever it is. We're going to do it.
That's the statement he made in 2012, obviously. What are we to make of all this? Does that make him a racist?
Well, and then the other big piece of information that came out, of course, is that he is a longtime close friend of Representative Elijah Cummings, who is the head of that committee, a Democrat, and who is an African-American. So it is a head-spinning series of events.
It's really hard to make sense of it. He's basically a birther, which is in line with the president, who he ardently supports. It's just surprising to see that came out in 2012.
So finally, we have to say goodbye to one of our most frequent and productive contributors to the Roundup and one of the mainstays of the reporting staff of the Charlotte Observer, Anne Doss Helms. You announced this week, actually yesterday was your last day at the
Observer.
It is.
I guess as of midnight, I'm a retiree.
I said, you took a buyout.
Yeah, basically, yes.
Did you want this to happen? This is happening in the newspaper industry at large and at McClatchy in particular.
I decided it was a good move for me at this time. I was not laid off or forced out. I feel certain I wouldn't have been. They're actually advertising for my job now, so if anybody has ever aspired to my glamorous lifestyle, you've got the chance.
Well, keep us in touch with where you are, and I'm really pleased to know that they're buying out your contract so you can take all your institutional memory with you when you go, and they're giving the head guy at McClatchy $35,000 a month in living expenses. Splendid. You can't say that, but I can.
You can.
Will and will continue to do so. And Doss Helms, thank you for your service.
Thank
Eric
you.
Spanberg, Jonathan Lowe, Steve Harrison, thank you for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.